Welcome to On Mic, conversations from Northgate Hall, the home of the University of California, Berkeley's Graduate School of Journalism. I'm Ed Wasserman, Dean of the Journalism School, or the J School as we call it. As one of the country's top journalism programs, we regularly host the world's best journalists, writers, and documentarians to talk about the stories behind their stories. For today's episode, we're proud to welcome acclaimed author Adam Hochschild. His recent book, Spain in Our Hearts, Americans in the Spanish Civil War, is a best-selling history told through the eyes of a dozen unexpected characters. Adam is a master of narrative, and his new book is an absorbing and brilliantly researched account of a time when Americans poured into Spain as volunteers for the democratic cause. Adam is also a lecturer here at the J School, and he is joined by our own Deirdre English, continuing lecturer and former editor of Mother Jones magazine.
Adam needs no further introduction from me after Ed Wasserman's eloquent introduction. I do want to say it's such a pleasure to have so many friends of Adam's here and friends of mine and of the J School to celebrate this remarkable achievement. We're at a journalism school, and it's often said that journalists write the first draft of history. And if you get a lot of things wrong in the first draft, they may persist. So it's so interesting then to say who is writing the third, the fourth, the fifth draft of history. Maybe Orwell wrote a second draft, and he revised his second draft, and I'd love to, for us to talk about that. So here's Adam with a much later draft of history in which you have a chance to go back and look with 2020 hindsight at many of the things that were missed at the time. So we're going to be exploring these issues. I thought I would start with reading a little bit from the book. And this is about Alva Bessi and his experiences. Do you want to say a few words about Alva Bessi before I read this?
Yeah, some of you may have known him because he lived in San Francisco much of the latter part of his life. He was an actor, a novelist, a journalist in the United States, went to Spain in his early 30s. Fought through the last 6 months of the war, wrote a superb book about it, Men in Battle, then came back to the U.S., was a screenwriter, was a member of the Hollywood Ten, went to prison for that, wrote a couple more books about Spain, and then ended up as the stage manager of at the Hungry Eye nightclub in San Francisco.
So let me read this, and then I'm going to ask Adam to contextualize it a little bit. But I think as you hear me read it, you'll also be thinking a little bit about the points that Adam made about Texaco and some of the behind-the-scenes things that even Alva Bessi didn't know as he wrote. A little bit of a long excerpt, but bear with me. So the Republican Army had received new anti-aircraft guns, but, Bessi wrote, we had so few that 75 planes merely sailed with exasperating ease through their sparse fire, and those are nationalist planes. But then, when 10 of ours appeared, they had to run a gauntlet of fire that blackened the sky for hundreds of acres. It was heartbreaking. Intense shelling filled the air, not just with shrapnel, but also with chips of rock blasted off the mountainsides. Bessie found a different sort of horror when the shelling passed. After all these hours, eight in all, when you tried to walk, rising from the narrow niche in which you had been lying all that day, it was almost impossible. Your legs refused to obey your mind, and you had to look at them to assure yourself that they were there and will them to move. Trying to relieve yourself some distance from the shelter, ready to jump and run at the sound of a distant gun, you tottered on your feet and fell back into your excrement. You wonder how much of this it would be possible to bear. One American sergeant clenched a short stick between his teeth to keep them from chattering. When Bessie's best friend was wounded and lost an eye, Bessie inherited his pistol sticky with blood and soon after got word that the friend had died in a hospital. A nationalist shell hit a food truck and the men had no food that night. A month after they crossed the river, the 768 men in the battalion had been reduced to 380. So, I think one of the things that this captures is the grimness of battle. Mm-hmm. And believe me, this is a gory book. You read battle after battle, And I'd like you to talk a little bit more, Adam, about the actual experiences like these that the American volunteers in the Lincolns actually experienced in the field. What was it really like for them? I don't know what they expected, but what was it really like?
Well, I think people always expect wars to be quick and glorious. And you'll go over to whether it's Spain or Europe in World War II or whatever. The fighting won't last long, but there will be flags flying, the enemy will fall back in disarray, and you'll come home, you know, covered with medals, and so on. People always tend to imagine this about wars, and in correspondence I saw from, and I spent a lot of time looking through letters that American volunteers wrote, you know, they're all writing their wives and sweethearts saying, I'll be home in a couple of months, this will all be over very quickly. And of course, it wasn't. It lasted much longer than anybody expected, as wars tend to. I mean, look at the recent ones the United States has gotten embroiled in Iraq and elsewhere. And it's much more grim than anybody expects. You know, when you volunteer to go to Spain, you don't imagine that the principal thing you're going to be eating is very, very tough mule meat, which one volunteer described tasted and felt like a mouthful of rubber bands. And it's those...
He said you swallow it and just hope your digestive juices will do the rest.
So it's not the glorious place that people expect.
Yes, make no mistake, this was a defeat. Mm-hmm. And this is a tragic story. It's the story of idealistic people who fought a losing cause. And in retrospect, that defeat seems somewhat preordained.
Yeah, I think it was preordained by the fact that the Western democracies would not step in. They had the latest and best arms, Britain, France. One of the characters I follow, Louis Fisher, a journalist, at one point, who traveled in and out of Spain several times during the war, at one point in 1937, was working in Paris and saw a Bastille Day parade and said, if we had 20% of this equipment in the Spanish Republic, we could win the war. That may have been an exaggeration, but I think the failure of the democracies to help in any way did foreordain the defeat.
And the Republicans had money to buy arms.
They did. They had this enormous supply of gold.
There were great gold reserves from their ill-gotten adventures as a colonial power.
Power and as trading with both sides during the First World War.
They were not able to use their gold to purchase arms because France and England
and
both
the United States all said no, and smaller countries tended to follow the lead of the big ones. Mm-hmm. The only country that willingly supplied arms, and actually at first didn't even ask to be paid for them, was Mexico. But it was very poor, very far away, and could not supply the kind of equipment, you know, the latest modern fighter planes and so on that was needed. They used about a quarter of the gold reserves to buy arms on the black market. But that was a very tricky business because even in the best of times, buying and selling arms is not a trade for amateurs. And people knew the Spanish Republic was desperate. Arms dealers promised arms they didn't have, collected payments for them. Planes arrived without machine guns. Machine guns arrived without bullets, and that was not very productive. The rest of the gold went to Russia.
Yeah, they gave their gold to Russia, and the Soviets provided them with arms, but often with arms that were old and defunct. Isn't that right?
At the beginning, the Soviets, the first shiploads of arms for the first couple of months, the Soviets used this as a chance to clean out of their warehouses all the antiquated and foreign arms that they had there. And they had a lot because they'd inherited a lot of this stuff from Tsarist Russia. And then in the Russian Civil War, there were at one point or another aiding the whites who got defeated, you know, American, French, British, Serbian, Italian troops, all with their own kinds of weapons that got left behind. And these were on the first ships to Spain. And you can read the accounts of the volunteers receiving them were just bewildered by, you know, all this stuff. Finally, though, the Soviets did begin sending up-to-date arms, especially fighter planes and tanks, without which the Republic could not have survived as long as it did. But then, by the time the war had been going for a year, Mussolini's submarines in the Mediterranean essentially started sinking all these Soviet arms ships, and that supply dried up.
So in that paragraph that I read, we're seeing what it's like on the ground from a soldier's point of view when the nationalist planes are flying, they're fueled, and the Republican forces don't have airplanes and don't have anti-aircraft weapons with which to shoot down their enemy. So they're fighting a losing battle, but here's where we really see the role of Texaco that you've described as having been so important, that there was a corporate foreign policy that was quite hidden.
Yeah, yeah.
And what is it that's, I know that some of the information that you have in your book is quite new, so can you describe that?
Yeah.
About Texaco.
It still is amazing to me that no journalist at the time explored this question. Where are the nationalists getting their oil? Because there didn't seem to be any way they could get it without violating U.S. law. But nobody asked the question, and I can say that pretty definitively, nobody, because a huge number of American newspapers from the 1930s are now digitized, and you can do searches for, you know, Texaco and Spain. Nothing comes up. The only mention I found of it anywhere was in the newspaper of the Wobblies, the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World, a one or two paragraph story where apparently a sailor on a Texaco tanker had written to the newspaper and said, they're making us take oil to Franco. Oh. That was it, no other mention. So I'm still bewildered.
Why the mainstream press should read the left press.
Yeah, that's right.
For a few ideas.
That's right. But it's bewildering to me why people didn't ask that question and explore it at the time. It came out, the part about Texaco selling oil at a discount and providing all this intelligence information was discovered by a Spanish scholar, Guillem Martinez, in recent years, who wrote about it in two articles in Spain, which very few historians have noticed. They're published in fairly obscure places. His discoveries have really not yet made it into the history books. I got in touch with him as soon as I saw these articles. He very generously shared his documents with me, including that letter that I showed you a picture of. And it's just quite remarkable to see this stream of intelligence information in English from an American corporation going to the Spanish nationalists.
And had this information been known, it would have made a huge difference because there was the conflict was so interesting and so much covered. There was so much sympathy in this country and in France and England, at least, for the Republicans, that it would have been quite scandalous information at the time had it been known.
It sure would have been.
So this is interesting because it's investigative history, and I think it helps, you know, to make my point about the umpteenth draft of history, and that it's never too late to actually get to the root of the story and find out that information that changes your perspective on the entire thing. But I do want to bring up, with Adam's book in my mind, I found myself looking at the news a little bit differently, and I want to share a few things and that will go to the point of how contemporary this kind of perspective is. Jane Mayer, in her new book, Dark Money, writes that the father of the billionaire brothers Charles and David Koch helped construct a major oil refinery in Nazi Germany that was personally approved by Adolf Hitler. One venture was a partnership with the American Nazi sympathizer William Rhodes Davis, and they built the third largest oil refinery in the Third Reich, a critical industrial cog in Hitler's war machine. So another example. But how about this for another example? The recently released Panama Papers. I just read in the New York Times that Mossack Fonseca, this law firm that was helping corporations hide their assets, helped oil companies conceal sales of fuel to the Syrian Air Force. So in our own time. So this perspective on investigating what corporations, the foreign policy of corporations, is at the heart of this book, and it continues to be completely relevant.
Deep Throat said it best to Woodward and Bernstein: "Follow the money."
Let's talk. We've been talking about the financing of the war and the corporate investigative reporting. Let's go back to talking about the politics, because many of the Lincolns were communists, and their ideals were absolutely tied up with communism. Many of them were socialists. Some of them were anarchists, and certainly in Spain there were many socialists and anarchists. But talk a little bit more about the factionalism on the left and how that affected the war itself.
Well, there were certainly people from many different political stripes who went to Spain, among the American volunteers. And one of the things I wanted to do in sort of choosing my cast of characters was to show people who had, you know, different attitudes towards the world politically. The Merrymans were party members, and most of the American volunteers were party members or sympathizers. Louis Fisher, the journalist I mentioned, who was actually the first American to go into uniform in Spain, although he did not stay there long. He reverted to being a journalist. He was the nation's correspondent there. He, for 15 years, had been an ardent true believer in communism, then began to get disillusioned in 1936 and went through his period of disillusionment, the Soviet purges and so on, while working in Spain, and ended up a very vocal anti-communist, but never regretted the time he spent supporting the Spanish Republic. Another person I follow is an Englishman, Pat Gurney, who fought with the American battalion for almost the entire war. He's the guy who fell in love with the nurse. And he was considered himself a sort of non-denominational radical. He knew he definitely was not a communist. He'd been to a Communist Party meeting or two. He said, "They're boring. They feel they have the correct answers to anything. If you try to make a joke, you're treated as if you farted in church." But he saw that the communists were the only people who were organizing large numbers of volunteers.
But the communists killed socialists.
They did. I think that there was certainly factional fighting within the Spanish Republic, because this anarchist-led social revolution in the Northeast was deeply horrified both the mainstream liberal parties of the Republic, who were no enthusiasts of revolution to begin with, and the Communist Party, which wanted a revolution that was controlled by them from the top down, as it happened in the Soviet Union. And this finally came to blows in May 1937, when there was street fighting in Barcelona in which several hundred people were killed. And this is one of the things Orwell writes about in Homage to Catalonia. Essentially, the social revolution was suppressed. And as I say, several hundred people were killed. There are probably somewhere between 30 and 50 Spanish anarchists and other non-communist leftists who died or were killed in prison in the Republic in the later months. Orwell's picture of this in Homage to Catalonia is very vivid, but he later decided that he had emphasized it too much. And because in Homage to Catalonia, he says, if the revolution had been allowed to go forward, we would have won the war, because people then would have felt inspired to fight. By 5 years later, when he wrote a long essay about the war, he had decided, as almost all historians would say today, they lost the war because Hitler and Mussolini were heavily funding and supporting the other side, and nobody was helping the Republic. And he actually left instructions for Homage to Catalonia to be rearranged accordingly, de-emphasizing the portions about the street fighting and so on, which was moved to an appendix. And his American publisher was unaware of this, And until I pointed it out to them a couple of years ago,
oh.
The book has since then been reissued the way that Orwell wanted it.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that you pointed it out. I want to open up to questions in a minute, but just before we do, you talk a lot about these writers, and so I just would like to give your thumbnail assessment of Orwell and Hemingway, and for journalists. So what would be your recommendation for journalists about what to read and how to read Orwell and Hemingway?
Good. I still think Homage to Catalonia is one of the great nonfiction books of the 20th century. And if anybody hasn't read it, read it. I've read it for the fourth and fifth time when writing my book. Hemingway's war reporting, I don't think, is very distinguished. He considered himself a soldier of the Republic, and he actually, at one point, even took part in a guerrilla raid across enemy lines. Yeah, Orwell was fighting too, mm-hmm. but he wrote his book after he'd left Spain. So the journalism that Hemingway did during the war, I don't think is his best work. After the war, when he wrote For Whom the Bell Tolls and a couple of short stories set in Spain, he was able to talk about all kinds of things, such as this factional fighting on the Republican side and the nastiness of some of the communists and so on, that he didn't want to say while the war was on. I actually think the best English language journalist covering the war is somebody who's been almost forgotten today, Virginia Cowles. 26 years old when she arrived in Spain, had never gone to college, had never covered a war before. I think she was the best on the scene. And her writing, when you read it today, her book about that period called Looking for Trouble was recently reissued. It's a wonderful read, and she's one of the very few reporters who covered the war from both sides, from the Republic side and the Nationalist side, and she was the first correspondent from anywhere to get Spanish officers to admit that they had bombed Guernica, which Franco and Hitler maintained had been blown up by retreating Republican troops.
That's a fantastic section about her getting the truth about Guernica out. Well, let me open this up. I know there must be so many thoughtful questions in the audience. So let's let people talk a bit about this. Yes.
Were American Jews overrepresented in the Abraham Lincoln Brigade?
Definitely, yes.
That was my impression, and why?
Yeah. Well, somewhere between a third and half of the American volunteers were Jewish. As was true for many of those from other countries. We don't know the precise figures because so many American Jews, like Americans of other descent, changed their names. I think for a couple of reasons. One is that Jews in the early mid-1930s were profoundly alarmed by Hitler's Germany, and they saw this as a chance to stop the advance of Nazism in some way. Jews have always been overrepresented in every conceivable faction of the American left. And this was also a war where probably a greater percentage of the volunteers than the population as a whole had at least some college education. So I think those were the principal reasons. They often found that, these international brigades were people from more than 50 countries, and many of the Americans report finding that Yiddish could be a common language when talking to people, volunteers from other countries.
Yes.
So I noticed that both sides of the Strait were controlled by the Gibraltar Straits were controlled by the Nationalists. Didn't they just stop these boats, like from Mexico, from getting through, or did they have some program?
Good question. I don't know about that's true. The arms from Mexico, which came right at the beginning, must have gone through the Straits of Gibraltar. But actually, the Nationalists, most of the Spanish Republic's navy had stayed loyal. So they did not actually have control of the sea lanes, especially in the opening months of the war. They got their troops, they had many troops that were in Spanish Morocco, was known as the Army of Africa. These were Arab and Berber mercenaries and something called the Spanish Foreign Legion. Hitler supplied planes which allowed them to airlift these troops to the Spanish mainland.
I'm curious about how the volunteers were treated in the aftermath of the war. You would think that the war against Hitler vindicated their precedence in going to war against fascism. I have a feeling that wasn't the case. By the late 40s, were they vilified about Albert Bessie, who went to prison? Can you talk a little bit about how the Lincoln Brigade and the United States were treated in the sort of collective memory of this country?
Well, generally pretty badly for many years. This was a time, of course, when J. Edgar Hoover controlled the FBI, was much more concerned about subversives of all kinds than he was about organized crime or anything else. A lot of the Lincolns had their passports confiscated when they arrived back in the U.S., especially if they arrived in a large group that was identifiable. The FBI routinely sent people to question them for decades afterwards. They couldn't actually be accused of a crime, but, you know, just as an intimidation thing, you know, Hoover sent FBI agents to question these veterans and to talk to their employers. And so it became hard for many of them to, you know, get work because, you know, you get hired somewhere and an FBI agent shows up to talk to your employer, it's not a good path to advancement, especially in the climate of the United States in the 40s and 50s. I think that began to change by the mid and late 1960s when there was a very vocal and active anti-war movement in this country, and a lot of us who were involved in it suddenly became interested in this generation who seemed to be our political ancestors in a way. And then you began to see people showing up in, you know, anti-war parades with signs saying veterans of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade and being cheered, which was a new experience for these folks.
Elizabeth.
What you find most difficult in writing this book and compare it with another book, if you could, that you might not have had that difficulty?
Well, actually, I think the difficult thing for me is this. You know, I love to tell stories and to find people whose stories I can tell. And the times when I get frustrated are when I wish I knew what somebody thought and felt at a particular moment, but I don't have a record of it. That's why I say keep diaries and keep your letters and so on. So, in choosing the cast of characters, I'm sort of steered by who did leave a written record of some sort. And actually, in this book, I had a somewhat easier time on that score than with a couple of the earlier books, because there's a really rich load of material to work from. For example, the 2,800 American volunteers, more than 200 of them, either they or members of their family, have donated letters, diaries, unpublished memoirs, other documents of some sort to an archive that's actually in a research library at New York University. I spent days and days and days there. Another source of material, and it's always fun when you can sort of come at somebody from several different directions, is this. Anybody here who, like me, has been in the military knows that armies run on vast amounts of paperwork. And all of the paperwork from the international brigades was taken back to Moscow just before the end of the war, and where it remained tightly locked up for more than half a century. Then the Soviet Union collapsed, and in the 1990s, the Russians realized there was money to be made by microfilming all this stuff and selling it to Western libraries. So at this same library at NYU and at certain other libraries in Europe, you can find more than 180 microfilm reels of personnel records of international brigade members. So all of the American volunteers I followed, I looked up their personnel records, and these are filled with letters they wrote, autobiographical statements that you had to write when you enlisted, comments on you from your superior officers, you know, you performed well or badly in a particular battle, sometimes a record of a feud or quarrel of some time, fascinating material, and again, it can run to 25, 30 pages per soldier. So that's a valuable source. Then, you know, the newspapers and magazines from the period. And often it's fascinating to see a difference between what somebody wrote for publication and what they put in their diary or what they put in a letter.
All the way in the back, there's been someone who's had her hand up for quite a while.
My question is, you sound like a conspiracy theorist, but it's hard to believe that no one in government knew of that Texaco link.
Actually, they knew about some of it. And I went through the papers of Roosevelt's attorney general at the time, Homer Cummings. The part that they were aware of was that the oil was going to nationalist Spain and it was going on credit. They didn't know about the huge discount. They didn't know about the flow of intelligence information. They discussed it at a cabinet meeting. And Roosevelt, who kind of blew hot and cold on this issue, according to his attorney general, notes that he made to Roosevelt, declared himself in favor of prosecution. But then he backed off. And all that Reber got was, and Texaco got, was a $22,000 fine for violating the provision of the law that said you shouldn't sell something on credit. They were never prosecuted more than that.
But he later said that he regretted not that the United States didn't arm the Republican
army. Roosevelt was filled with ambivalence about this. And actually, in late 1938, when the Republic seemed to be losing the war, he actually toyed with ideas of getting arms there via third countries, but then backed away from it. And then just before they lost for good, early 1939, he said, we made a grave mistake, he said, in a cabinet meeting by not selling them arms. But by then it was too late.
Yes, right here. Again, here comes the mic.
Well, I'm very fascinated by the Spanish Civil War. And the human interest part is what fascinates me. There was a time, let's say in the mid-1930s, when communism was actually very respectable. And many intelligent people thought that was really the way to go. And what happened during the Spanish Civil War is they got disillusioned. And they saw it wasn't, well, not all.
Well, the Moscow trials are happening during that same period.
Yeah, Moscow, but also, so what about this experience of disillusionment? You gave some examples. To me, that's kind of amazing.
Yeah.
People went, and then they, oh my God, this is not what we thought it was.
And perhaps you can touch on Merriman in that regard.
Well, I'm also fascinated by this process of illusion and disillusion about communism, as among many other things. Of the Americans who took part in the Spanish Civil War, there are virtually none of them, as I said at the beginning, you know, the majority of them were party members or supporters, members of its affiliated organizations. Virtually none of them seem to have been disillusioned by their experiences in Spain. The big things, I think, were the Hitler-Stalin Pact of 1939. That led to a big exodus from the party. The bigger exodus came in 1956 when Khrushchev's secret speech about Stalin's crimes was released. And as I say in the book, that's like the Pope himself admitting that the Protestants were right all along. And that's when the big exodus from the party came. And there are accounts you can read of his speech was read aloud at a meeting of the party's national committee. And there were a number of Spanish Civil War veterans there. People had tears rolling down their cheeks. That was the point when the big exodus
came.
What about Orwell? Well, I don't think Orwell... You know, Orwell was never a Communist Party member. I don't think he fully realized the nature of what was going on in the Soviet Union, but he certainly did not go there as a true believer. And when he arrived, he enlisted in the militia unit of a party known as an acronym from its initials in Spanish, the PUM, a party that was on the left but very anti-Stalinist. He enlisted in that militia at the start. And ironically, shortly before this factional fighting broke out in Barcelona, Orwell had returned to Barcelona in order to transfer to the International Brigades. Even though he knew they were controlled by the communists, which he didn't like, he felt they were engaged in the battle for Madrid, which was the big battle of the war. He was on a kind of sleepy, inactive section of the front.
Well, talk about Merriman a little bit in this regard.
Merriman and his
wife. Our Berkeley graduate, yeah. Economics graduate student.
They were both party members. They didn't actually join until they got to Spain, but they were certainly sympathizers when they were here in Berkeley. They lived in the Soviet Union for a couple of years after leaving Berkeley because Bob was researching his PhD thesis there. And all that was going on in the Soviet Union at that time, the first of the purge trials, the aftermath of the big famine, man-made famine in which millions of people died, it all seems to have passed him by and had no effect on him. And it's fascinating to me that somebody who was a star graduate student here at Berkeley, head teaching fellow in the Department of Economics, could hold this illusion so tightly.
And it's another example where we started talking about the fog of war, or the difficulty in, not in that case war, but the difficulty often of understanding the current moment, that the moment that you are actually living. I mean, the things that he missed were hiding in plain sight that Merriman missed in the Soviet Union, and that was true also of the Nation correspondent.
Louis
we
Fisher.
Don't have time yeah. to talk about him anymore. We're going to have to wrap up, but this is someone who was a total apologist for Stalin and also had a wife and children he was protecting after he became disillusioned, and who at the end of his life is having an affair with Stalin's daughter, who was another who had turned against Stalin yeah. herself and came to live in Princeton. So yeah. that's another whole story, another whole profile that's in this book. We've barely tapped the riches of this book. I can't recommend it strongly enough. I feel as though I've been really, really living it, and it's caused me to want to reread Orwell and reread Hemingway, and rethink many things that Adam has brought to light. So, thank you so much, Adam, for having written this book.
We've been listening to Adam Hochschild, author of Spain in Our Hearts: Americans in the Spanish Civil War, in conversation with Deirdre English. This has been On Mic, a podcast presentation of the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism. Technical facilities for On Mic are underwritten by the Jonathan Logan Family Foundation. Lacey Jane Roberts is our producer, and I'm Dean Ed Wasserman. Thanks for listening, and I hope you can join us next time.